Welcome to the podcast, Entrepreneur Perspectives, building and protecting your business one podcast at a time, a Kezsource family production. This podcast exists in large part because of KezCM, the content marketing business inside Kezsource Inc. So what does KezCM do? You know how many business leaders need help communicating their story? Well, that's what we do. Content creation and distribution for business leaders. This provides opportunities, relationships, and a platform for you and your business. Why do we do this? Because at KezCM, we exist to help business leaders build a meaningful legacy that is worth living and leaving. Learn more by visiting KezCM.com. In this episode, we discuss the military lifestyle, overcoming adversity, and lessons from the cockpit. When all is, play my cards right. Our guest today is Frank Van Buren, speaker, author, and advisor. Growing up in a military family, Frank spent most of his young life traveling and always learning from the military community. After his college football career was ended due to injury, Frank joined the U.S. Army and earned his silver U.S. Army's aviator wings. Through much adversity, Frank now shares his stories, lessons, and mentorship to those around him. He shares his stories in many ways, including his book called Life Lessons from the Cockpit. Frank currently resides in Charlotte, North Carolina with his family, where they enjoy their 30-acre farm. Frank's examples of helping business leaders overcome adversity were on full display in our chat. His success in business and life has us so excited to feature him on this podcast. And with so much to talk about, let's get right into this episode and welcome Frank Van Buren. You came out with this one video and it was really quick. You hit it as the different things you wish you knew at age 22. And I believe your father told you, you cannot soar with the eagles if you hang out with the turkeys. And I just loved it. And I promise you, I went home that night and my son's the oldest and I have two daughters, you know, younger than him. So I go to my son and I tell him that immediately. And I said, I just love that. And I'm sure it's been said before, but sometimes you run across people that have a way of saying things. And I don't know what that way is. And they just have a way of they communicate it. And the way you distributed that on LinkedIn, it was very subtle. It was very simple. And the line is good. And it just delivered it to me in a way that you hear it all the time. You know, if you hang out with the wrong crowd, blah, blah, you know, all those things. But this is the way you delivered it was just different to me. I don't know why. Maybe it was just me. But tell me and the listeners, whoever, about that line, where it came from, because I just loved it. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, anyone who's listening can go to LinkedIn, follow Frank, and you'll see that little video.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the one-minute pieces that I've been doing. And just as a little background, Eric, I've committed to doing 365, so 1 year worth of daily pieces, 1 minute or less. And the whole idea is... to help me clarify the messages in a obviously clear and concise manner that can be digested by a large group of people who are most of the time pretty busy and they value their time. So I did write a book called Life Lessons from the Cockpit. Obviously, that would require a larger commitment of time, but I wanted to figure out a way to reach large amounts of people on a daily basis with excellent content. And that particular piece, just to step back a little bit more, my father was a military officer. He served the country for 36 years, 20 years as an Army officer, and then 16 years in the government. So I grew up on military installations. 9 out of the first 13 years of my life were spent on an Army base in Germany. And he was very much, you know, the classic military kind of guy, you know, believed in giving a lot of lessons to his kids. And that one used to always make us laugh. But I'll tell you, Eric, it had, you know, it was really understandable to all of us when he put it in that context about, you know, if you want to be an eagle, if you want to be someone that's accomplishing great things and that distinguishes yourself from everyone else, there's no way you can do it if you spend a lot of your time hanging around with people who don't necessarily have the same level of ambition and a mindset of goal accomplishment. And that wasn't to say you should be disloyal or you should disown anyone who doesn't fall in that category. It was just a simple shot across the bow saying, you know, if you want to achieve your maximum potential, then you're going to have to be around people who are positive, constructive. They challenge you. They help you to grow. And I think all of us understand that from an athletic standpoint. If we're on a team with really good players, the practices are as competitive as the games. and it brings out the best and you become a better player. If you play in an area or on a team with subpar players or players that you are dominant against them on the field, then, you know, your only development comes in the game. So you get, you know, fewer reps going against difficult people. So I think that was his way of telling us, you know, be very cautious with your associations. And he didn't mean that in an arrogant way. He meant that in a very real way, because it is important.
It absolutely is. So when he was telling you these things, or as you've, you know, as you were getting older, did you find yourself hanging out with the turkeys and it was, you know, letting you know that you got to stop doing this? Was there certain situations that you went through as a child that were the, your father woke you up a little bit?
Well, you know, there was one that, and, you know, on the military, in the military community, it's not very nuanced. It's very binary. In other words, right, wrong, this is our set of values and this is how we live. And so that was good, especially for a kid who doesn't have to appreciate nuance so early in life. You just kind of have to know what is considered to be right and wrong. And I remember when I was in seventh grade, I went to take a test, and a buddy of mine had written down the answers. I have no idea, Eric, to this day, how he got the answers, but he wrote down the answers and he wrote them down for me also. And he handed them to me before we walked into this little quiz. I'm not even sure how important it was. But I put it in my pocket and I did not pull it out during the test. I'm not sure why I didn't pull it out, but I didn't pull the paper out. Well, it turns out he gets caught. And the first thing he does is he sings like a canary and points me out. And so the teacher called home and told my mother. And of course, she called my father's office and told him. And I remember when he came home, I was trying to argue my case saying, but Dad, I didn't look at it. I didn't pull it out of my pocket. And I remember him saying, I don't care. The fact that you had it in your pocket is, you know, crime enough. And the intent is, as you know, as bad as the crime, you shouldn't have had it in your pocket. You should have been able to understand that this boy was doing something that was going to be detrimental to you, and you should have not gone along with it. And so he drew the line there. And I think that was clear at that point that, you know, the whole turkey eagle thing, you know, it was easy to be grouped with the turkeys if you allowed yourself to slip into that point. So, you know, I think that was a experience I'll always remember. I guess the most difficult thing for me is I am by nature a people person. I like engaging all people. I don't necessarily distinguish along those lines, but I always like to think that, you know, if I'm more of an eagle, maybe they'll become more of an eagle. So I had to always control my associations, but at the same time, you know, we always want to reach back, lift people up that we think have the capabilities and the intent. The truth is, though, a lot of people in that category of turkeys, they don't have the intent or the desire or the work ethic. And so a lot of times you can't bring them along, but sometimes you can. And so it's always worth trying. But, you know, that was sort of the story behind that one.
Well, it's a lesson because, you know, you could think, well, you did something really wrong and perhaps you didn't. But he was able to dive deeper into it and maybe let you see there's something bigger going on here, because as you grow up through life, if you're in the military, if you're in business, if you're becoming a leader just in society in general, that intent matters. And that is that wake-up call that you're talking about. And there's different characteristics, different levels of where people are at in their life. And if you're the one that understands the intent from the beginning to the end, that is a true leader. And like you just said, you're setting the pace. It's a pace car. So you can pull people with you. If you're setting that pace very fast, they can keep up with you or they can't. It's one way or the other. Like you said, it's binary. And I think that's important to have people like yourself in other people's lives. And that's why it's so great to have a conversation with someone like you that's been in the military, but then you were talking about before growing up in a military family. And it sounds like there's a lot of ethics involved. There's no cutting corners.
Absolutely.
Right? And that has
Absolutely.
To lead. Yeah, that has to lead down the road to, you know, when you get to the military, but even fast forwarding past the military, and we're going to talk about all this stuff, and you're in business, that, wait a second, doing the right thing is always the right thing. And it's always been taught that way. I have no idea how to cut a corner because it was ingrained in me that that's just not what you do, right?
Absolutely. And the way you explain that is very much the case with the military community. And remember, a lot of it is based on, if you're a leader in the military, a lot of times people are looking at you towards your bearing, towards your approach, and towards how you're handling problems to set the tone on how they will follow and how they will handle problems. And so there's a huge amount of reliance in the military on one another. There's a deep level of camaraderie, and that camaraderie is based on mutual interest and mutual responsibilities. And so what I learned in the military is, and that's carried over to business, is, you know, you have to create an environment, a team environment, where you try to bring out the best in everyone on the team. And, you know, I always like to think back when I was flying helicopters, if you were an experienced pilot in the unit and a new pilot showed up, it was incumbent upon you to get them up to speed as soon as possible, partially because, you know, your welfare was on the line also. You know, if someone is your co-pilot, they have a huge amount of responsibility in the operation, in the conduct of the operation. But also, you never know if you were going to be wounded or hurt or disabled in some sort of way, and the other person's going to have to carry a larger load. And oftentimes in the military, people have to step up quickly. So there is a sense in the military that it is all of our responsibility to get every team member, especially the weakest member, up to speed. It's very much opposite of an environment where, you know, your value is based on being able to distinguish yourself as exceptionally good versus everyone else on your same team. I mean, that concept doesn't exist in the military. Everyone is trying to figure out how to make the overall team stronger. And I've always carried that to my conduct and how I go about my day in the business world also. And I think it's been really valuable and it's been rewarded over time.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I remember at one situation we had at our office, we hired someone who came highly recommended, very good at their job, you know, good track record, all that, come to the office, and I didn't catch the signs right away. And then what it turned out to be is, you know, a little bit into it, and this individual self-selected themselves out, which is fine because there's, you know, other opportunities for people. But it, realizing that it was a closed door for this person. This person didn't want to be bothered, didn't want to talk, didn't want to train anybody. If anyone had a question, wanted nothing to do with it, wanted to do their work, get home, and be done with it, and didn't want to help bring other people onto the team. And this is early on as we're building this company and we're trying to create a culture, you know, a teamwork culture. And like you said, we have people now that want to assist. You know, we have Scott in our office, and Scott is seen as this individual that people can go into and they can get help from him. He will pull you along. You might not know how to do this yet, but we're going to get you to where you need to be, because as these things come around, right, it's very different, obviously, and we're going to talk about this, than being in the military. But at the same time, in a business, these people can't not be caught up to speed as to where they are. It's going to take some time and have patience with them, but you get them to where they're going. So, you know, it's just kind of reflecting a little bit on what you said as to what's going on at a very small scale. It's what's going on in our business. And you bring this up and you say the word Black Hawk, right? So a lot of people listening in military, and my grandfather was in the Navy, and they you know, he was overseas. So my mom was and my aunt we're in Niagara Falls, New York. But see, he's all over the place in the Navy, but, you know, they visited different naval bases and understand what a military family is. My business partner, Shane Snively, was in the Air Force. So it's been interesting to be around these types of people that have lived this, and then to hear someone like you talk, but someone who's very recently been in the military and also been in a Black Hawk. And you hear that, and, you know, for, you know, the mass media would hear Black Hawk Down, the movie, right? And the dangers that it's involved with it, and fighting for this country, and all the things that have happened with our country and wars and different things that have happened, that it's just amazing to have you here sharing your stories, not only in our podcast, but in the book that you wrote. I want to hear a little bit about, like, your stories of being in the military. How did you find yourself, you know, flying a helicopter for the United States Army?
Yeah, it's really an interesting story, and it actually starts with the athletic side of it, the football side, if you'll allow me to step back a little bit. But
absolutely.
You know, when I was in high school, my first real memory or big lesson that I took away from high school football, when I was a sophomore, I was a I was playing on the varsity as a defensive player, D-back, and I was a second or third string running back backing up some of the older guys. Well, the starter got hurt, and they decided that I was going to play in his as a substitute for him. And I don't know if this actually happened, but the captain of the team, Mike Norling, who was a big defensive tackle, walked up to me, and he said that the coach told him that I was a JV-level running back. Now, I don't know if he said that to motivate me, if he was really good with people, but it stung so much, and it hurt so much, and I was so angry that it motivated me beyond what I probably would have been. Every time I had the ball, I fought for a few extra yards. Every time we went to do weightlifting, I tried to work harder than everyone else. That stuck with me for a long time, and it helped me to become a better player. And by the time I was a senior, I was a college prospect and the captain of the team. So my first lesson from athletics in high school was that sometimes hurt and sometimes anger and sometimes people doubting you, if it's used properly, can be an amazing type of fuel to propel you to your best person. And so I try to remember that in business also. You know, if a customer or a competitor doubts you, I mean, instead of using it to self-destruct, you can also use it to make yourself a better person and a better business and a better team, et cetera. But carrying on with the story, so back then, when you went through recruiting, college football recruiting, it was kind of murky and ambiguous. You didn't really know how good you were relative to people across the country. We didn't have Rivals.com. We didn't have Scout and all these recruiting services and the internet to see what other people are doing. So if you were pretty good in your county, I was in Silver Spring, Maryland, Montgomery County, right outside of D.C., you also, you know, you kind of thought you were, you know, going to be the starting tailback for Nebraska. I mean, you didn't have the clarity and the transparency to really know where you fit. So I was being recruited by some D1 programs, and it turned out on signing day that I didn't get signed, which was another moment of, oh, now I'm really motivated. And it turns out that I'd gone to a camp my junior year at a small school in Pennsylvania called Shippensburg University, a Division II school. And that coach called my father that day, and he said, you know, did Frank get signed? And my dad said, no, he didn't. So why don't you bring him back up here? We really loved him when he was here. So I ended up going to Shippensburg University, and, you know, over my time there, I became a, you know, two-time All-Conference, one-time honorable mention Division II All-American. I had 5 school records as a running back. But probably the most important moment was during my junior year when I had a catastrophic knee injury. Now, this happened in the 7th game of my junior year, and the prognosis was really bad. 5 of the 6 major structures, you know, anterior cruciate, lateral, medial collateral, you know, all of the major structures were totally blown. And the doctors that day after the surgery said I'd be lucky to run again. Of course, here we go again with the doubt that just propelled me to work hard. I ended up by the next season, which, you know, was a little less than a year later, I had rehabbed my way back to the starting lineup as a running back and captain of the team, as well as being honored with an award called the Ray Else Fighting Heart Award. It's about overcoming adversity. But that whole process of overcoming adversity gave me one more year on the football field. I wasn't as fast. I certainly wasn't as explosive. But it was a great lesson in life on overcoming adversity. But the other thing, Eric, that it did was it threw off my ROTC training. And, you know, when I got to Shippensburg University, because of my background, family background in the military, I joined ROTC. But you're supposed to go through a advanced training camp, ROTC training camp, between your junior and senior year in college. Well, that was after I injured my knee. So the Army allowed me to post. Selection process for the particular areas that you could go into in the Army. So fast forward, I finish my my 4 years at Shippensburg. I finished my last season of football. I graduate. I go down to Fort Bragg, North Carolina for my officer's training that my peer group had done 1 year earlier, the summer before. So I was behind. And the last 3 days of the training, we did a field exercise. And the most significant moment was when, you know, 10 Blackhawks landed in the field and picked all of the trainees up, and they flew us right on top of the trees. It's called Map of the Earth. It's extremely tactical, very fast, low level, and it's exhilarating. And I got off that helicopter and I was lit up like a Christmas tree, and I knew what I wanted to do in life. And the problem was, because I was behind in the selection process because of my knee injury that delayed my training, the allocations for my year group were already done. So I went through this process of going into the Guard and Reserve, sitting in a unit where I felt incredibly miserable because I was the only, well, one of the few that were not, you know, a rated aviator. So, you know, I was in charge of the motor pool. And, you know, they told me it would be, you know, 2 years before I was able to go to flight school. Well, and this was a Guard and Reserve unit, so I was just doing it on the weekends. I also had a job selling fax machines during the week for Harris 3M, and I stumbled upon the Warrant Officers Association. And in a weird technical twist, this gentleman in the Warrant Officers Association building told me that if I really wanted to be a pilot, I could do it, but I'd have to take some exceptional risk, and that would be to resign my commission as a second lieutenant, which was the title I had in the Guard and Reserve, go back in as an E3 private, so as if I had never gone to college, but under the conditions that once I go through a warrant officer candidate school, I would then be entered into flight school, and if I did well, I'd be able to fly the best aircraft on active duty, which was what my dream at the time. And I took the risk, I resigned my commission, I rolled the dice. The whole story of all the ups and downs of what I went through are in the book, Life Lessons from the Cockpit. I won't ruin the book, but I'll just say it's an amazing journey. And that's how I ended up getting to flight school. And then the process of learning how to fly a helicopter was very difficult and always done under an amazing amount of pressure, because the military wants to train you so that you can handle any situation when you're out in the fleet and it occurs. But that whole process got me to flight school and ended up starting off my career as a Black Hawk pilot, which was, you know, I treasure those 6 years going all over the world, flying aircraft on behalf of our nation in places like the Middle East. I was in Central America. I was in the European theater. So it was an amazing experience, and I learned quite a bit, and it was living a dream.
There's so much to unpack there. With going back to this conversation when your teammate walks up to you and says you're a JV-level talent, right? Or the coach told him to say that, or whatever was said there, whether it was the master motivation, yeah. Right? And at that moment, and so I want to stay there for a second, because – there's a lot of talk right now. There's a lot of showcasing how good somebody is and a lot of down talking somebody else. You're not good enough. You shouldn't be there. And that's been going on forever. Obviously you dealt with it. You know, we have kids today that are playing sports and the kids are being told they're no good. And it's whether by their teammates, their coaches, other parents, parents on the other team, who knows what it is. And these are like 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 20, whatever that might be. What do you tell, I'm going to go forward from here, but what do you tell a young kid that is dealing with that today, that is not even close to realizing what their potential might be? And maybe it's in a sport or business, whatever else. And they show up and they're on the field and someone says that they're no good. They think they maybe are pretty good. Maybe some people have told them they're pretty good. And then someone shows up and says they're not. So it's very easy to say, you got to strap out, you know, you get it back. You can do it. But like, going through what you've been through, what do you tell the young individual that's dealing with it, coming from someone who's dealt with it, and then it led on to all these great things that we're going to talk about?
Yeah, that's a fantastic point, Eric. I would say the first thing I would always say to a young person, old person, that goes through that moment of hurt when someone tells them that they're not good enough is that whether they are right or wrong, it only matters how they react to it. And this is the key. It can go either way at that moment. That's the real truth. You can either embrace it as a challenge and use that hurt, that sting, that pain to keep you going when your body hurts, your mind hurts, you're tired, you don't want to do more. And this applies to much more than football. This is business too. You can use that to do the extra business call. You know, you can, you know, when you want to quit, you can say, you know what, I'm just thinking of that guy saying that. But you can also let it destroy you. And that is what I always say to young people. This is an amazing moment in your life. You've now been given, you're at a crossroads. And how you react to this is probably more important than what was said. But it obviously had an effect on you. So I try to get them to see that, one, the experts are not always right. I mean, you and I know that. And the more you live, the more you realize that the experts are not always right. There are always players out there, I mean, that excel on the field that were told, you know, what do you think they told Wes Welker? I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of players that were told, you have no chance of playing in the NFL and the NBA. But, you know, Muggsy Bogues, people like that have learned to take that and channel that as a positive source of fuel. And it's rocket fuel because it gets them going whenever they're feeling down, whenever they're tired. And I've had friends that went through Navy SEAL training. They were the smallest person there. His name is Jim Nelson, who ended up flying helicopters later. But he used to say every time he heard or saw one of these big muscular, you know, classic Navy SEAL looking fellows ringing the bell, quit. He would get stronger. And he was the smallest, weakest one in the class, and he made it. The point is, it's all about how you react to it. So that's the first thing that I would say to them, Eric. The second thing I would say to them is you have to be willing to put in the work to improve, you know. And that's a truth that people have to recognize. Athletes are not good because they come out of the womb good. Maybe some of them have natural attributes and they're talented. But, you know, we forget that Jordan and Kobe Bryant took 1,000 shots a day. I mean, they were relentless in how much they practiced, even though they were really good. And so that kind of work ethic has to be combined with the jet fuel of the, you know, of the sting of whatever was said to you, whether it's on the playing field or in the business.
Yeah, I love the story when they talk about Kobe Bryant. He tells when he was at a basketball camp, and he came from a, you know, his father played professionally, and he goes to camp, and they thought he wasn't good. They thought he was soft because he came from a quote unquote good family. And what was interesting is when they all went to lunch, he stayed in the gym and he kept working. So he said they can try to, you know, push him down and say that he's soft, but he's just going to outwork everybody to a point where they couldn't say anything anymore. So like you just said, you had to keep working through it. So you come to this incredible moment, like you said, and you took it upon yourself to see it in the best way possible, and you push through, and as a result, things happen, right? It wasn't necessarily that, oh, you end up playing professional football. It was you saw the next thing and the next thing, and next thing you know, the helicopter, the Blackhawk shows up, and you're like, that's it. That's the epiphany. That's like, that's what I want to do. But it was I think you kind of take it back. I'm sure there's moments in earlier in your life that probably led to that just the same. But that moment of someone telling you that and identifying, say, that was the moment, and you get there. And next thing you know, it's like, oh, wow, I found my calling. This is what I want to be doing. And it is those moments that you talk about. And that's what leads to a good conversation. It leads to an incredible book that we all need to read, right? To have that moment to get to that point.
Eric, you bring up something that I really try to stress with young people all the time, and my friends and I talk about it, and that is most of opportunity in life is created when there is inertia or activity or momentum. In other words, you find out that if a door is attractive to you and it's cracked open and you kick that door in and run through it, it doesn't have to be the last door that you will run through, because oftentimes when you create that activity, that inertia, there are three more doors in the next room. And you never know about those three doors unless you go through the first door. And so kind of life has to be lived with forward progress. You know, as a football running back, they always said, keep your forward progress. You get another 3 yards, you know, you get hit, you keep your forward progress, your shoulder square, you know, you dive for another 2 yards. That's good. The coach loves that, right? And you always wanted to be going north-south. And that's sort of how I've tried to live life. And I always recommend talented young people, when they're coming out of school and they don't know exactly what they want to do, but if they can figure out who they are, I really talk a lot about introspection, what their dominant attributes are and their interests, and they see something that interests them, well, go as hard as you can in that area. Give it all you can, because oftentimes it opens up doors, because people sense when they're around someone that wants to accomplish things. And without ruining the book, when I walked through that door selling fax machines that day and met the gentleman, his name was Don Hess from the Warrant Officers Association, who explained to me a different path to get to flight school. He liked me. We ended up talking an hour because I think he sensed that I was a young person that wanted to do something positive with my life. And so he wanted to invest in me. I can tell you right now, 52, I always try to see young people who want to accomplish things and then figure out if there's any way I can help move them forward, because it's all about forward progress. And when I see people who have a good education or even not a good education, but they have talent and they're sitting there waiting for this, you know, this perfect opportunity, or they're unmotivated, I know that they're going to miss some opportunities that probably would happen if they were moving forward. The best football analogy I'll give is on the football field, if you get people that are flying around the field, you never know when that fumble, you know, you're going to cause a fumble, it's going to bounce one way, fast guy's going to pick it up and score for you. You create opportunities when you have people flying on the field and you have people moving and creating inertia. And I think that's been a big takeaway in my life, is that, you know, when I went to start this, the business that I'm working on now, and on the side of personal development, which is the combination of the books, I'm doing the social media platform, I'm giving speeches. I have a goal of doing 30 this year. I've done 16 so far, so I'm on pace. I want to release the second book. I have a lot of goals, but a lot of that comes from, I'm not sure how this is all going to turn out, Eric. I really don't know. All I know is I'm just going to go hard and see what happens.
Well, that's just it, because you continue to push yourself, because we could look back at different moments, whether it was your football career or, you know, being in the military and then going into business, you know, being in the finance world, to now pushing into personal development. And I don't take it, you know, we're talking as we talk, you've had a full day of work, as have I, and it's not that late, but it's, you know, it's 10 after 6 on the East Coast right now, and you're still pushing through. And I imagine you're the type that's going home and you know, you have a family and you're going to do all the great things. I've seen pictures of your family, you know, incredible family, and you're going to continue to push and not stop, you know, even though you've had this incredible success, and you could define success by whatever that is, but you're going to continue to push, which is also lessons for someone that you're leading to say you're doing it and you're showing them the way, you're blazing that trail. So talk a little bit about like what your day looks like, because so many people are like, well, yeah, but he's successful. He had this adversity trait. I don't know what it is about these military guys, but you know, you read the book Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins. You're like, it's unbelievable what he had gone through to get to where he got and continues to do it on a daily basis. And every time he's running, he's doing a video, he's running with his shirt off and he doesn't stop. And it's not motivation, because I love what he said about motivation. He said, motivation's crap, because when you go outside and you go for a run, yeah, it's great. You know, it's 72 degrees outside, but then you live in Chicago and you open the door and the wind hits you 50 miles an hour. You go back inside and crawl under the covers. Where's motivation then? So motivation is not what that was about. But then you see these people and you're like, well, I can't be like that. That's not me. And, you know, it's just, how do you continue to push it? Because you're the type of person that can show the way to say, wait, no. None of us had that. Because you can go look at David Goggins. We can go read your book and learn about what that was like. Talk about that a little bit. I don't even know what the question is there, but it's big.
No. I have several lines I want to go down. The first, before I go any farther, is to say that a lot of people ask me about fear of failure. And in the book, I address this right off the bat. And that is, Everyone has a fear of failure. If you ask me, do I have fear of failure? My quick answer would be no, but then my real nuanced answer would be yes, but I have a greater fear, and that's the fear of regret. Like, I've always been the person who said, well, if I don't want to be on my deathbed, at, you know, hopefully late in life, and look back and say, I wish I would have tried to start this speaking business, or I wish I would have tried to write a book, because I think the fear of regret, to me, turns my stomach. It's you only live once, and you just have to try to do your best, you know, and it's all measured against yourself. Like, are you trying to get better every day? So I always try to, whenever I have, when I'm nervous or when I'm worried or I have fear, I always supersede that with the fear of regret, and I'm able to do a lot of things without fear. In other words, the fear has been repressed. But, you know, it's natural when you're learning how to fly a helicopter and you're, you know, sitting in a running aircraft, you have no real experience, and the instructor tells you to pick it up in between two other student piloted aircraft who are rotor blades full turning, and you're thinking, I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to kill everyone. So there's, of course, some fear, but you learn how to deal with it because you're more concerned about regret. So that's the first thing I will say. You know, the other thing I will say is, you know, most of the people that I served with in the military, including the really extraordinary people, and someone like David is, I mean, when you read his book, you know that he has figured out a way to manage pain, and his threshold for things might be exceptionally high relative to everyone else. But you can take away a lot of lessons, because if you want to be successful, I think you have to study the belief systems of successful people. That's always been my number one thing. I studied successful people. I remember reading The Strangest Secret by Earl Nightingale, and he said, you know, what you think, you become. You know, who you emulate are the qualities that you'll demonstrate when you need it. So I wanted to read about Winston Churchill. What was he thinking about, you know, during the height of the bomb, when they were being bombed to smithereens by the Luftwaffe? I mean, why didn't he give up? How did he go out there and give that speech? I wanted to know how Frederick Douglass went from being, you know, a slave to an educated abolitionist who could motivate the nation with his oratory. How the heck did that happen? I want to study him. I want to know that. I want to know, you know, how people push through these things, because we're all just normal people who are trying to do good things with our lives. And the only way we do it is to emulate people who have demonstrated they have a belief system. And so, you know, if you want to be, you know, good at something, if you want to be a really good business person, it seems to me wise to study really good business people. And you're not, you know, the difference is you don't want to be a follower. You want to be a student. A follower just blindly doesn't use any discretion, says, well, that guy did it, that's what I'm going to do. No, it's not necessarily right for you, but you can understand by, as a student, what the belief system was that went into that person thinking about things in a certain way. And how, why did they get up at a certain hour of the day? What was their routine? What were they reading? How did they study? You know, how did they handle adversity and obstacles? And those kind of things are really important. And so that's the second thing I would say about it. As far as my day-to-day activity, I get up at about 5:15 every morning. I live on a farm about 50 minutes from Charlotte. We moved out there about 4 years ago. We love it out there. But I drive in, and we have a 7:30 meeting. My job is a bond salesperson for Wells Fargo. What that means is, on a day-to-day basis, I'm using the phone, I'm using all sorts of communication methods to talk to institutional investors like insurance companies, mutual funds, hedge funds, who have large pools of money that they want to invest in the high-yield bond market. So corporate bonds are, you know, just loans that are freely tradable for anyone who doesn't have a finance background, and it allows an investor, let's say your insurance company, who collects your premium, my premium, you know, everyone sends them $100 every month. They aggregate all that money, and then they have to invest it so that if someone crashes their car 3 years from now, or if someone passes away, life insurance, and obviously, Eric, you know this because you're an insurance expert, but for maybe some of the listing. Well, that those insurance companies have to have the actuaries tell them, okay, you're going to have this much in liabilities in year 7, 8, 9. So they need to invest for it. So some of the customers that I cover are large insurance companies or mutual funds, hedge funds. And so I talk to them throughout the day. A lot of it is done on the phone. There are customer visits. There are, you know, entertainment where you take them out to a game or something. But most of it is done throughout the day. And when they tell me what they want to do, either buy or sell, or I give them an idea, I then look over and talk to my trader. The traders sit directly opposite from us. And their job is to understand at any moment in the day what the proper value is on any security that's being traded in their portfolio of names. And so all day we're just trading around bonds and creating what we call a marketplace or liquidity for investors that want to buy and sell corporate bonds. So I do that throughout the day. I usually end the day at about 5:30. And then after that, you know, I usually try to do a post, either one of the Wish I Knew at 22 posts. Actually, I've been doing those in the morning. And then in the evening, I have another post I've been doing called Where's the Book, which is just kind of a collection of stories of people that are reading my book. So that's when I really try to work on my personal development stuff. Oftentimes, I'm going to a kid's game. I have a son that plays lacrosse, another son that plays you know, soccer and, you know, flag football. So I'm in a daughter that does ballet. So, you know, it's trying to balance all of these things. But at the end of the day, we have to try to live our best lives. I definitely don't think I have any extraordinary talents. I think I have, you know, I have some really good attributes. One is I do like working with people. I do like public speaking. These are things that I think I've always had a love for. And that's why I really want to focus on it. And it's helped me in my job on the trading floor. But I always go back to those fundamental lessons I learned in the military about showing up, working hard, being a team player, being unselfish, you know, leading by example, taking on more than I'm asked, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's not a 9-to-5 job. How about that, right? It's it can be if that's what you want, and there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you're looking for. But if you're looking to push and you're looking to push the envelope and cross bears and do the different things, like you said, soar with the eagles, it requires more than that. And you can have multiple interests, I see. You know, you're up early in the morning, you have a family, you're doing things, you want to get in personal development, you got your business, and you have to be on when you're talking to these institutional investors, these insurance companies, these hedge funds, you have to be on constantly. And it's a full-time job. And that's something that you just have to love what you do, obviously. And I think that's very basic, but it's very real. And you have to find, I guess, what those other interests may be, you know, because what's it going to get you? What if you go out there and you create these videos on LinkedIn? What does that mean? Well, if you have an interest in pushing yourself out there to be a leader in personal development and you want to have, like you said, 30 speaking engagements during the year, well, you're going to have to do these things because that's how someone's going to find you. That's how we connected, right? I think you saw something we posted and then we connected and engaged and had conversations from there, but that's why you do it. It seems sometimes you're like, why did I put this out there? It's 1 minute, it's 5 minutes, whatever. Who's going to pay attention to it? But you do it over and over and over again. The consistency shows up, and I'm just excited to hear someone like yourself talk about this because it helps us understand the direction that we're going, because some days you can show up and you're like, what am I doing? And I love your stories about what you study, the belief systems that you study. As I was building the business, I started reading a lot of biographies, whether it's the Phil Knight story, Shoe Dog, you know, building Nike, or Jeff Bezos talking about Amazon, or Steve Jobs, these different, they're extreme examples. We don't have to go build out Amazon. There's only one Amazon. There's only one Jeff Bezos. But it was interesting to me to say, well, they had to have someone who was designated as the person that ran across to the bank every day to make sure their line of credit stayed open. Because if their line of credit shut down, Amazon doesn't exist today. Or Phil Knight being overseas and trying to like play pretend like, yeah, he's got East Coast distribution. When he gets back to the country, he tells his friend, he's like, congratulations, you're moving to the East Coast. You can either move to Baltimore or Boston. Pick a city because you're going today. You know, it's like, this is how they ran their business. And you look at it today and it's like, oh, wow, they're just wildly, obviously successful companies. But it's like, there's these extreme stories that you can learn from and apply on a small scale to whatever it is you're doing. And you obviously did that with your military background and your business growth and pushing through the adversity and what you think you become. I love that. I mean, because we just have to continue to tell ourselves that all the time, right? I mean, you can't ever stop, but you have bad days too, right? It's not always like you wake up at 5:15. It's like, all right, let's go. It can't be that way, can it?
not at all. In fact, one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book is that in jobs like, you know, being a military aviator or even, you know, sales and trading or investment banking, which I did before sales and trading, I think a lot of people put so much glamour around the jobs and they don't realize that there is a tremendous amount of struggle and hardship and adversity that people go through, self-doubt. All of these disabling emotions are being felt by the people at the highest level accomplishing the greatest things. And I always like to say, you know, the greatest learning in life comes at the moment of adversity. If I look back on my life, of course, the day I blew out my knee, I thought it was the worst thing in the world. In retrospect, it turned out to be one of my finest moments because I came back from that and I established myself as a person that could handle deep adversity. When I think about some of the things in the book when missions went wrong and or when I, you know, I won't give away the stories in the book, but there were some, you know, very, very, very near-death experiences. One of them was completely my fault as the pilot in command. And, you know, I had to just own that. I had to own the failure. And it felt bad. But by owning it, you then realize that, you know, you can learn a great deal from it. So the best way I can frame this up is my mother, who is 95, a former Rosie the Riveter during World War II. My parents are somewhat older than me. I was the youngest child. My dad would be 102 if he was alive now. My mom is 95. But anyway, stepping back a little bit, my mom, when she read the book last month at 95, she said, "You know, Frank, I'm so happy you wrote this book." And I said, "Why, Mom?" And she said, "Because I never knew these things about you." Now, this is your mother. This is my mother saying. She said, "I always saw you going off to accomplish your goals. And then we saw you coming back. We saw you, we went down to your graduation. We saw the wings being pinned on you." She said, "I never knew about the struggles in between." She goes, "I assume that, you know, you had some hardship, but it was good to hear you talking and sharing some of these disabling thoughts that you had and how you figured out how to push through them and overcome." And that is the main lesson of what I'm trying to say right now, is that if people are listening to this and they're thinking about their inadequacies or they're thinking about their lack of particular skills or attributes, just know that many people who have accomplished great things have gone through the same process of self-doubt. If you've ever read the book 1776 by David McAuliffe, the most striking thing in that book to me, Eric, was that George Washington had a tremendous amount of self-doubt as the leader of the Continental Army. And as not only our ability to win against the British, but also his ability to lead. And I thought that was strange because I thought, wait a second, George Washington, he was the greatest leader ever. Like, this guy, you know, led us to victory against a powerhouse. And then when you read about his thoughts and what he said, you're like, okay, if he dealt with it and he had self-doubt and he still overcame, he still drove through, so can I in whatever I'm doing.
Well, that's 100% it. I remember this past year, I took my kids to see the play Hamilton, and there's a line when George Washington comes out and he says, "I'm doing the best I can." And you're like, wait a second, that's George Washington. Like you just said, like, you know, what do you mean you do the best you can? You're doing the greatest. You know, you're the first president, all these things. And like you just said, there's other people going through it. There's a few things I want to pick on, and I know we've been talking for a while and I could keep you all day, but there's definitely a few things I want to touch on. And something you just said about your mom, because your mom was glad that you wrote that, and she's 95 years old. I'm sure eventually your kids might feel that same way, and their kids, and so on. This is one, when you said that, this is one of the greatest reasons why to create content. It might never lead to business. It might never lead to you getting a speaking engagement, but there's someone somewhere out there, chances are it could be a part of your family, maybe it's not. They are going to be glad that you shared what you shared. And it, you know, your incredible story, but it's not, you don't have to have, I don't think, a military background. You don't have to have this incredible, like, defining moment, and you it led to this and led to that. That's great, and those are great, but there's other ways, and the more you tell, that's why I have this pie. I have three children. I have, you know, I think about my grandfather. I think about my ancestors, my, you know, my family, and they are kicked out of different countries, and what they would do if they had the opportunity that we have in this country. Yeah, there's stuff going on here, but we got it pretty good, you know, and you think about what they could have done with this opportunity, or what they did to get their ancestor, their, you know, generations after them, the opportunity to do what we're doing now. Let's not let that down. You know, it sounds cliche, and it sounds maybe cheesy, I suppose, but like, nah, man, if you really get deep with that, I think about that stuff all the time because it's so important. And it's, you know, they're in the military. You're in the military. Like, what are we going to do? It's like, that's why we have Memorial Day and Veterans Day. It's those little reminders. But if you think about just how it is in your family, but you telling that story about your mom and she's glad and she had an opportunity to read that. I know two of my biggest fans of my podcast, and if there's only two people ever to listen to it, are my mom and my aunt. And that's no joke. They listen to it. They tell me about my father as well. You know, but it's like, that matters.
You're triggering some thoughts.
I'm trying, yeah.
One of the regrets. No, it's a fantastic, fantastic podcast. Always good. And I'm really enjoying this one. Obviously, we're engaged in conversation. One of the regrets I have in life, and remember I said my biggest fear is regret, is that my father died when I was 21. He did see me get pinned as a second lieutenant, so that was nice. But he never knew I was going to go on to flight school because of this weird series of events where I resigned my commission and went. But one of the things that I always thought was remarkable, my father and his brother during World War II, remember at the time African Americans were second class citizens, they volunteered and went over and fought in the war in the segregated army platoons as second lieutenants. They were senior. My dad was a senior at Howard University. He left school, trained to become an officer. His brother was a junior. They went over. My uncle ended up getting killed during the North Africa campaign. He's buried in Tunisia. And my father survived the war, obviously, went on to stay 36 years with the U.S. government. And he had a great opportunity to go either way. Like, he could have been bitter that, you know, after two wars, he still couldn't vote, right? I mean, but he always said he always loved this country, had a positive attitude, and he always said, you know, they were just making progress so that we could get to the ideal country that we wanted. And so my regret is I never asked him enough about his experiences. Because he died when I was 21, and I just hadn't grasped how important his life experiences were. And there, you know, there wasn't a book, there wasn't a podcast or notes. I mean, I just remember some stories he told me, but I never sat down and said, all right, tell me about the time you shipped off. Where did you go? Where did the ship go? Tell me about the first engagement you guys were in Germany. I mean, I didn't ask him any of that. And so, fast forwarding to today, I wanted to leave some sort of record. And, you know, obviously, if you have kids, you know, you can get on your soapbox and you wonder if they're getting any of it. But one of my greatest, the things that give me the greatest happiness right now is I see that my 18-year-old and 16-year-olds listen to the one, they listen to the one-minute videos all the time. And they've read the book. And my youngest, 12 years old, he and I read the book together. We go through chapter. We had a couple chapters left. But the point is, sometimes you're writing the content not because you have some agenda. People always want to say, how many books did you sell? And the truth is, I do know, and I follow that, but I don't. That's not the value of the book. The book was to see if my experiences can impact other people's lives in a positive way. The value was leaving a legacy for my kids. The value was when my mother, who's 95, said, I learned a lot about my son reading that book, and I'm happy about that I learned that. I mean, to me, if I never sold a book, like you said, if you never had, you know, if the podcast never got to the levels that you wanted to get to, it would still be worth it. And so that's a big part of what we have to do. We have to find out what is worthy of our time. In other words, what gives us a sense of fulfillment, and, you know, what do we think is important for our overarching vision, what we want out of life. That's something I always talk to young people about. What do you want out of life? You know, and then what are your attributes and where are they valued? And then go about it that way.
Do you find that when you're creating content and telling these stories, that a couple of things, one, that it's a little bit of a reminder to yourself to keep you in check, to keep you moving down the right path, but there's also some self-talk. I went through this realization. I might have been partly when I was reading David Goggins' book, and it was like, I was like, wait a second, I'm not personally me pretending to know all these things. And we write content, we give ideas and consider doing this, and here's some motivation there, whatever that might be. But I'm realizing as I think about it, and I knew it at the time, but then you really, like, it comes to top of mind perhaps. It's a lot, and I wrote an article about this, it's a lot of self-talk too. So it's, and it's helping. So if I can self-talk myself, and I feel like if it's good enough for me, then it's good enough for me to share with you, because I'm using it myself. So I feel like that's good enough, if that makes sense. Do you find yourself having those reminders and that self-talk in the stories, like when you talk about Soaring with the Eagles and anything else that you share?
Yeah, and I love the way you put that. That's absolutely the case. And I always try to frame things up. If I was in that person's shoes, what would be the most valuable thing that, you know, in this case, I'm talking third person, that Frank Van Buren could say or share? So a lot of times, and when I wrote the book, I didn't frame it so that it made me to look like this triumphant aviator, because I didn't think that the real value to people was creating a larger bunker for them to think, oh, I could never do something like that. The truth is, I didn't even know I could do it when I started. I know that I was willing to try, and the risk of or the fear of failure was far subordinate to my fear of regret. And I was going to try it. I was all in. And I could have failed. And there were many times where I didn't know if I was going to make through flight school. I didn't go down there as like some kid that had flown before or had a private pilot's license. I didn't know any of that. I just knew that this is something that I wanted to do, and I was willing to accept failure to extinguish that road. I wanted to go down that road. And so I always say the self-talk to me is, you know, it's valuable to me to think back of, you know, not only my own personal experiences about overcoming adversity, because it helps me as I go forward today, but also learning about other people's adversity. For example, if I think back to the world that Frederick Douglass or my father lived in versus everything that we have today, it's hard for me to be negative about some small slight, right? Because I think too many people, regardless of who you are, your background, your gender, whatever, I think a lot of times we allow ourselves to get so easily sidetracked by things that shouldn't knock you off your, you know, off your path. They should be simply a little twig on the road that you step over and keep going. And so I think for me, the self-talk is also, it helps motivate me, but it helps me to also clarify in my mind what might be helpful to impact other people. And many times it's sharing with them the struggles that I went through. Everyone, to this day, you know, if you think of an astronaut or a surgeon, you're thinking they were probably born good enough to do that. But then when you talk to someone, you know, that's, you know, achieved at the highest levels, oftentimes you'll hear about a heck of a lot of adversity and struggle and, you know, hardships that they had to go through to get to that level. And I think it's important that people know that so they're not discouraged so easily.
Have you learned as well from your, you talked about before, the different countries you've been in and obviously being around the world, and obviously you're studying belief systems and reading about Frederick Douglass and George Washington and going on. And then you go to other cultures, you go to other countries and you see what they are, they're dealing with there. Incredible countries, but a lot of different things happening. Then you come back here and you realize the different opportunity that you have. So you're studying the beliefs and you're reading about it, but you're also seeing what the world has to offer. Travel. How important has travel been to you in your life?
I'll tell you a story. My first duty assignment out of flight school as a Black Hawk pilot was I was sent to Sotocano Air Base in Central America, in Honduras. And one of our jobs, we did a lot of jobs. We did drug interdiction. We did some special forces moving around those guys in different places like El Salvador. But the one that stuck out and the largest mission that we had was called nation building. And a lot of times what that included was using our Black Hawk helicopters to fly to these extremely remote locations in Honduras, many times on the side of a mountain, 14,000 feet up, or in a triple canopy jungle that couldn't be reached by normal means. And the skill that we had as aviators combined with the might of the U.S. military allowed us to do amazing good for people. And that sense, when you would, as you're approaching one of these, mountain villages, they'd always take a little white flag. It was, a piece of cloth and put it on a stick. That's how they would mark the LZ, the landing zone. And as we would circle, you would see people, they were like ants walking to this location up a mountain, I will say, many in bare, barefooted, many at the greatest levels of poverty you would ever see. And we would land and they would just treat us with the most gracious hospitality you would ever see. And when I would go into those situations and just, socialize with the kids, we always would bring either candy or, they actually like pens and paper better than they did candy because they could write. It always made me think, oh my gosh, I was lucky to be born in America, because the obstacles that someone living on the side of a mountain in a third world village in Honduras with no access to running water, no access to education, very little medical care that we had to deliver. And yet a lot of them approached the day with a smile and positivity. And I used to all, whenever I would get down or start feeling sorry for myself for any reason, I would think back to landing in those villages and I would say, you got to be kidding me. I mean, I'm not facing any real challenge compared to some of the things I've seen around the world. And that was just one in Honduras. There were many. So I think a lot of times if we knew how fortunate we were in America, and it's always interesting how, migrants, come here and they do great things. They work hard. They see the opportunity. In one generation, their kids are doing great. And I think it's because they recognize the opportunity. And I think many times if you're born here, we don't really value the opportunity of being an American as we should.
It becomes very relative, right? Unless you've seen it, unless you've gotten all out and visited other locations, even if you can't leave the country, you can stay in the country and visit different cities just to see what different people, how they react, how they respond. What's it like to live in the mountains versus the city versus the coast versus the plains? There's all these different things going on, but I think you're right. It's that it's so much what's right in front of you and not exploring what's outside of it. But people like you sharing your stories, where you've been, you can give it some color so we can think about it. We can put ourselves in that situation. We can have that image to hopefully help us see the world that we're trying to see on a day-to-day basis without, so like you just said, oh wow, there's this log in front of me. No, it's not a log. It's like a little twig, like you said, or it's a leaf. It's like, just keep going. Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal.
As we
get into the quick question, quick answer part, just the very end of it, and we'll get you out of here. And you're talking about travel a little bit. You've been to a lot of places. What's your favorite place to go to? Or what's the favorite place you've been to, I should say?
I would say on the island of Cyprus. I was stationed on Royal Air Force Base there, and we would go to a place called Ayia Napa, which was an absolute beautiful beach, clear water, white sandy beaches. And probably within an hour and a half, you could drive to the Trudos Mountains and ski if you wanted to. It's an amazing island in the Mediterranean, a combination of all activities. That was a great year on that island. And I would say that's probably my favorite place to visit and my favorite place to live.
Yeah, it's funny. This is the second time I've heard Cyprus mentioned in the last 2 days, which you don't hear that often. I was yesterday, my son had a soccer team meeting with his new coach, and his new coach is from France. He's traveled again, telling stories of all the different places he's been, and he talked about Cyprus just like you did. And I think that's funny. You don't hear 2 days in a row I heard about Cyprus. So you're obviously using social media, Instagram, LinkedIn for business. What's your favorite social media app to use?
For business, I would say it's LinkedIn. I think it has the greatest scale and the greatest collection of people who are probably naturally ambitious and naturally interested in self-development. I like Instagram because of the clean, quick feedback that you can get, and the fact that, you know, it's very obvious if people want to follow you or not on Instagram. They just drop you. I think it's more difficult on LinkedIn because there are so many connections that people think about. Like, if I drop this person, how is that person that he's in the network with going to respond? So for business, I like LinkedIn. I think it's the best app. But just I think the cleanest app for just getting feedback on the content that I'm putting out, these 1 minute videos, is really quick with Instagram.
Has I know obviously it's helping your personal development business as you, you know, push down the road with that. Has it also helped you with your current company and your current, you know, relationships that you have to be on LinkedIn, to have content created, in a sense that for a lot of people would say, well, it might not help. Do you see it, you know, being an engaging platform or someone to recognize and learn a little bit more about you?
Yeah, and I think it's important that, you know, I do get support from the bank. Because I think they see it as me doing something positive and trying to add value and have a positive effect on people's lives. And that reflects well on the corporation also, even though I'm not doing it in the name of the corporation. I think especially when it comes to young people coming onto the bank platform, or more specifically, when I talk to veterans groups, and, you know, Wells Fargo has a huge veterans transition program, I think it adds a lot of credibility and value that people can connect and see the content that I'm putting out. So it's been a win-win, very positive. I've received a lot of support, no pushback at all. But I think part of that is because I'm doing something positive. I'm using social media to add value and not to create any additional problems.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by it because I think it's great when you have someone who's considered in, say, corporate America, for the large, very large company, that's able to create content not only to continue to create down the road for other things that they might be interested in helping people, but doing it inside that world, that it can actually help just with those relationships altogether. It is not, there's nothing bad that can come from it. Like we said before, if you're doing the right thing, you can't be wrong, and everyone's going to want to be a part of that, and they're going to allow you to have that type of platform. So I think that's great. So I know obviously you're a big football guy. You played football. I'm not sure if you follow. You have a busy day, you have family. You're going to your kids' games and all that. So it sounds like you're still a fan of sports in general. If I were to only allow you to root for one sports team for the rest of your life, what sports team would that be?
I would say my kids' lacrosse team, Team Carolina 24/7. But as far as, you know, I don't miss one of his games. In fact, last summer I drove 5,000 miles in 6 weeks supporting, you know, going, because he's a pretty advanced player. He's a rising junior in high school, so they only play kind of in the hotspot tournaments. You know, I grew up a Redskins fan. I've now become a Panthers fan. I don't know if I'm a Panthers fan for eternity, but I love watching Panthers. I like what they're doing. Coach Ron Rivera is an amazing man. I saw him at, you know, he does a lot with the Veterans Bridge Home here. I've listened to him give his lunch speeches a couple times. He comes from a military background. So I'm going to go with the Panthers. I love that organization. And more importantly, I think that they got a great leader in Coach Rivera. And so I'm going to go with them. Great players, too.
Absolutely. All right. So you're maybe this question, it applies to everybody, I guess, but you've had a lot of opportunities to, you know, learn from your father, to be in the military, to come to these epiphanies, and now you're helping other people do it. But I think, and you might have already explained one of these stories before, but I like to ask our guests, when was the moment you told yourself you needed to make it happen and you gave yourself absolutely no excuses?
Okay, I don't want to ruin the story in the book, but I'll give you a snapshot of it. When I was in flight school, I had a stick buddy, my partner, who washed out of flight training early on. I won't tell you exactly what happened, but he washed out. I was the sole student to an instructor, Mr. Dennis Thorpe, who was a Vietnam veteran, very flamboyant, kind of witty guy, but very, very good instructor. And he put everything into me, and he put me up first for what's called the P2, or the Phase 2 check ride. And I went up for that check ride, and everyone knew I was the first one in the class to advance. They were thinking that under the assumption that I was the best student. I didn't feel that way. I don't think anyone felt that way in flight school. You were always feeling like you needed more time. You didn't know what you were doing. You were going to get yourself killed. But I went up for my P2 check ride, and I had a bad draw. I got DES or Department of Evaluation and Standards instructor. They're really, really tough. And right off the bat, I made a couple of mistakes, 100% my fault. It got me rattled. The thing went downhill from there. I messed up a maneuver and he had to take over the controls and I knew I was toast at that point. So I had to go back to the barracks and tell everyone that, you know, the glory guy that went first to do the test had blown it miserably and failed. And I laid in bed that night. Luckily, my friends in the unit, the other pilots, student pilots, you know, kept it fun in the barracks, typical barracks humor. Everyone was laughing and joking. But I think everyone knew I was in trouble because if I failed it in 3 or 4 days after remedial training, I was washed out. I was going to follow that first guy that washed out. And everything that I'd done, all the dice that I rolled to get there, and in the book I profile, there were a lot of obstacles to get through until I got there. Everything was riding on me coming back. And I just remember I was just laying there feeling very sorry for myself. And I just said, you know what? I'm not going out like that. It's 100% my fault. I should have passed that test. I messed up. I let the guy rattle me. And I went back and saw Mr. Thorpe, who was very disappointed in me. He put me back through the paces in the training. I ended up, you know, 4 or 5 days later taking it again and passing with flying colors. But that was the moment when I'm laying in the barracks. You know, everyone knows, oh my God, he's about to wash out if he fails again. And there was no one to blame, no one to point fingers at. It was all on me. And I knew my whole family, everything was riding on, could I pass the next test? And I couldn't make any excuses. And I just sucked it up. And I went back and I just said, if I go out, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory. And I did everything I needed to do, and it obviously turned out well, and, you know, the rest of flight school went really well, but that was probably the point that it could all turned on the dime, and it, you know, it worked, but sometimes you get punched in the nose, and you just got to get up.
Well, you're obviously someone we need to pay attention to. I'm just honored that you spent this much time with us. I'm excited to just continue watching what you put out there, what, you know, sharing what you've been sharing and the new stuff that you're going to be sharing down the road. I just really appreciate it. And I think, a lot of other people will as well. And I know you've already, I read the reviews on your website, for example, and clearly you've helped a lot of people. You've touched a lot of lives, and I know you're going to continue to do that. And you've already done that in your military background. I know your father did that, and we're just honored for your service and honored that, you know, just all you continue to share, encourage you to continue to do it. Love to have you on the podcast. Love to continue to chat more. I want to ask you, what's the best way someone could buy your book and also connect with you, whether on social media or in any way that you want?
The book is available on multiple channels. Amazon might be the easiest for most people. On Amazon, there's, you know, a hard copy, there's a paperback, there's audio, then you can go iTunes, audible.com. Barnes & Noble also has it in hardback. So I would say those are the best ways to do either Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or one of the audio platforms. So that's the best way on the book. And if anyone invests in it, I really hope it's a fun read for you. I hope you get a lot of positive personal reflection and it affects you in a positive way. As far as social media, I would appreciate either LinkedIn or Instagram. Oh, and my Instagram handle is at Van Buren Frank. So just last name, first name. And then LinkedIn, you know, obviously you can just find me with my name there.
Absolutely. We'll put that all in the show notes so people can easily click right over to you and connect with you. And like I said, watch your videos. They need to do that. Get the book and just pay attention to what you have going on. I know we will. But I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and Eric, I want to personally thank you. I love what you guys are doing. I appreciated John reaching out to me, and this has been really a lot of fun. I hope we can do it again. I'm always available. Let me know how I can help. You know, that is the whole story that, you know, you and I came together just by both trying to do good things, and I'd encourage anyone who's, you know, thinking that, well, should I try something? Just try it, get going. Just do something small, move the body, move the needle, and you never know what's going to come. I never knew I was going to be on this podcast. This is something that's manifests itself through inertia. So hopefully we all keep trying to do good things and help each other out.
You got it, Frank. Frank, it has been absolutely awesome having you on this podcast. from the lessons you've shared to your incredible work ethic, we're all better off from the time we spent with you. The perspectives from Frank on overcoming adversity are now perspectives you, the business leader, can use for yourself. And for that, Frank, thank you. And for anyone looking to talk to Frank about personal development, we encourage you to reach out to him. If you have questions, feel free to reach out to me directly. You can find me on LinkedIn or contact me on Twitter at Eric_Kaz. Thank you for listening to our Kazsource podcast, Entrepreneurial Perspectives, building and protecting your business one podcast at a time. Until next time, we're out of here. This podcast exists in large part because of KazCM, the content marketing business inside KazSource, Inc. KazCM is excited to bring the content marketing services used at KazSource to you. Learn more by visiting KazCM.com.